Welcome to our first message on the book of Joshua. This is the sixth book of 66 in the Protestant Bible. Over the past few years, I've had the distinct pleasure of preaching verse by verse through the first five books, and the leap to the sixth book is a pretty big transition. The first five books are often contemplated as a set. They were all written by Moses. In Hebrew, they are called the Torah, the Law. And in English, we call them the Pentateuch, Greek for the five volumes. But with the book of Joshua, we break from the books of Moses and move into new territory. Joshua is the first book generally grouped with the books of history, which include Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, and so forth. And this book is named for both its main character and its author. So it's a pretty big shift after spending 47 months on the works of one man. Today, we're going to be covering introductory material. And we're also going to discuss the first chapter of the book. And by the way, I think we'll get through this book much faster than we got through Moses. Much of this book is narrative, which moves faster than the thorny ethics and deep theology of the law. We've also got about seven chapters, depending on which ones you decide to count, which are devoted to describing the inheritances of various plots of land. And while we're looking at it, my supposition is that I'm going to have less commentary on that. Then again, I'm known to spend more time than you might expect digging up interesting facts about genealogies, so I guess we'll see what happens. But then, Joshua is only 24 chapters anyway, so I don't see how we could possibly still be studying it at the end of 2020. But that aside, we'll be looking at Joshua chapter 1 today, and it is largely a framing for the book to come. In the chapter, God gives instructions to Joshua that he should lead the people in conquest of the Promised Land, and he gives them instructions on how he should do it. So Joshua gives these first instructions to the people for the coming invasion. So then, if you haven't yet read Joshua chapter 1, I recommend that you pause and read it now. Since this is the introduction of a new book, I think a recap of what has happened in the Bible thus far is in order. The Bible tells a continuous story, and so while you can pick up from here and follow along, you're going to benefit from having at least a basic understanding of the previous context. So here's a quick overview. First, God created the world. He put two people in it. They sinned. For that, a curse of death came on the world, and all mankind were born with sin and separated from God. When sin became ripe, God wiped the worst sinners off the earth with a flood, leaving only one man, Noah, and his family. But that wasn't enough to correct the sin problem. So God chose a man, Abraham, and told him that the whole world would be blessed through his descendants, whom he promised to give a certain piece of land. That land belonged at the time to the Canaanites, a wicked and cursed people descended from Noah. Abraham's descendants, the Israelites, wound up being taken as slaves in the land of Egypt, where they were brutally oppressed, but they did not forget God's promise of giving them the land of Canaan. In his time, God chose Moses, one of Abraham's descendants, to lead the people of Israel out of slavery. And God performed many miraculous signs in leading the people out of Egypt. Thereafter, the Israelites wandered the wilderness, and God gave them a set of laws which they should use to govern their society and restrain sin. Those laws are today most remembered for their famous Ten Commandments. After 40 years of wandering the wilderness, God brought the people of Israel to the borders of Canaan and ordered that they should completely destroy the Canaanites and take the land. Moses, by that time a very old man, ascended Mount Nebo, looked out over the Promised Land, and died, leaving his right-hand man Joshua as the new undisputed leader of Israel. And so the stage is set. Joshua is ready to assume command of Israel's forces, and the book of Joshua will focus on the remainder of Joshua's life, in which he leads the long-awaited conquest of Canaan. Now, it would take a fair amount of time for you to go back and listen to everything we've said thus far, but if you wanted to just go back and listen to sermons which prominently featured Joshua, you could go to the Messages page by clicking the red icon, and you could search for the topic Joshua, and a handful of messages will pop up. Among those, we have him fighting against the Amalekites in Exodus 17, accompanying Moses when Israel's elders saw God in Exodus 24, and being appointed Moses' successor in Deuteronomy 31, and so forth. With the tour behind us, let's talk a little bit more about the book of Joshua itself. The first obvious question that anyone wants to know about any book is, who wrote it? In this case, the answer is Joshua. And we know it was Joshua because the book itself attributes authorship to him. You can find that in Joshua 24:26, which reads in part, "And Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God. Of note, that quotation was taken from the English Standard Version, abbreviated ESV. The ESV is my go-to translation, so if I ever forget to tell you which translation I used, it's pretty safe to assume I used that one. So, the book says that Joshua wrote it, and my default position is to take the book at its word. In fact, I would argue that when studying any ancient document, that should be our default position. The book has his name on it. It says at the end that he wrote it. This attribution was accepted by generations of scholars for thousands of years. To doubt it, without some kind of compelling evidence, would lead us down a rabbit hole of doubting the authenticity of all historical accounts simply because they are old, in which case we could know nothing about history. It would be a big problem. And yet, I think we should spend a moment on the topic of authorship, because there are many pseudo-scholars of repute who claim that Joshua is not the author. In fact, the Wikipedia article on the Book of Joshua confidently claims in its introduction that, quote, almost all scholars agree that the Book of Joshua holds little historical value. The article cites the work of an archaeologist from Pennsylvania State University by the name of Anne Killebrew, who writes that the opinion among scholars that the Book of Joshua is inauthentic is, quote, almost without exception, end quote. And I find that to be quite strange, because there are millions of educated Christians who believe that the book is divinely inspired, inerrant truth, and tens of thousands of pastors, many of whom graduated seminary, who labor in teaching and studying this book as an authentic historical document. And I'm sure that there are plenty of professors in Christian schools who believe just the same thing. But then there's the rub. I don't know anything about Miss Killebrew personally, so I can't speak directly about her, but Christians should be cognizant of the fact that there is a great deal of bias in modern academic circles. Publicly funded universities are secular, meaning that they don't openly permit religion. Religious people tend not to flock to publicly funded universities, and publicly funded universities tend not to hire and promote religious people. In a state-funded school, a religious leader, no matter how much he has studied, will not be viewed as a fellow scholar. So there is a self-defeating feedback loop at work. Most so-called scholars don't accept the authenticity of the Bible, because people who accept the authenticity of the Bible aren't regarded as scholars. The claim, then, from secular academia might just as well be most people who don't believe the Bible don't believe the Bible. So you can see how that's circular and not particularly helpful. As for us, we're going to accept the reality rather than the line fed to us by an irreligious state-run educational apparatus. Most scholars who have studied this book accept its authenticity, and it makes good historical sense to accept the historical records for what they say instead of inventing new opinions based on digging up some old pottery shards and analyzing them in light of a worldview which is biased to reject the existence of God. And while state-funded secular academia would never publish as much, there are internal evidences within the Book of Joshua in which it both claims to be from the time in which Joshua lived and which point to its having authentically been from that time. For example, the book claims in chapter 6, verse 25, that Rahab, a character whom we will encounter in coming weeks, was still alive when the book was written. If that's the case, it couldn't have been written in any other generation. And there are several other mentions which date the book to Joshua's lifetime. Joshua often described things as continuing to go on, quote, to this day, end quote, that being the day in his own lifetime. And later biblical passages would describe how those things no longer continued at later periods of time. It also accurately uses ancient place names which would not have been in use at the time when secular scholars claimed that the book was written. So either the author lived in that time period, or he had a significant historical knowledge and created a pretty convincing forgery. But there is no reason to believe that the account is false, and ancient Jews and Jesus and his apostles and the early church and everyone for all of Christian history until the advent of the secular worldview accepted the authenticity of the book, and so we will continue to do so. Now, if you're looking for some more details concerning things in the book pointing to its time period, I've found a helpful little list of such things, which I will link in the library for your perusal. And for those of you who might not have listened to Messages at East Jordan previously, we cite all of our sources in the library section of the site, which you can access by clicking the yellow icon. But there isn't much available there unless you create an account. If we displayed everything to everyone, there'd just be a huge list of citations with no context. So if you create an account, we'll display relevant resources to you once you've listened to the message. To view those, you'll sign in with your account, answer a simple quiz question here to demonstrate that you listened through the message, and then your resources will appear both in the library and on this message page as well. And of course, answering your quiz question will have the added benefit of helping you keep track of which sermons you've heard and which ones you haven't. With the textual metadata out of the way, let's move on to the contents of the book themselves. Chapter 1 of Joshua picks up where Deuteronomy left off. Moses had died, leaving Joshua as his successor, and so God spoke to Joshua. God pointed out that Moses had died. This, of course, was significant because Moses had been forbidden to enter the Promised Land. He was the last thing keeping Israel out. But with Moses gone, God is ready for Joshua to move on. He orders Joshua, therefore, to go over the Jordan River, that being the boundary between the Israelites and the Promised Land, with all the people of Israel. And the command came with some promises. First promise, every place they walked would be given to them. God had promised Moses that they would inherit the land, and so they would. And God lists the places that they might go, the forests of Lebanon in the north, the land of the Hittites in the south, the Euphrates River in the east, and the great Mediterranean Sea in the west. Promise number two, in all these places where they would fight in conquest, the peoples would not be able to stand against Joshua. That isn't to say that there would be no losses or setbacks, but ultimately, during Joshua's lifetime, anyone who fought against him would fall. Promise number three, God would be with Joshua as he was with Moses. Now, this is not to be taken to mean that they would have the same closeness of relationship as God and Moses did. Deuteronomy told us that no prophet had the same kind of face-to-face dealings with God, but the passage clarifies that God would not abandon Joshua. Joshua would be Israel's leader, and he would stay in that position, and would have God's help while he was there. And by the way, those promises make an excellent introduction to the book of Joshua, because they tell us just what is going to happen in the book. God is going to be with Joshua, the people are going to cross into the Promised Land, and they are going to conquer that land. When we reach the conclusion of the book, we'll be at the end of Joshua's life. God will still be with him, and he will have been a great military conqueror. And since Joshua could know that God would be with him, God told Joshua, not once, not twice, but thrice, that he should be strong and courageous. And indeed, the conquest of the Promised Land would involve many dangerous and frightening experiences which the man would need courage and strength to overcome. The Israelites are going up against enemies who are stronger than they are. The Canaanites have been in the land for centuries. They know the lay of the land, and they have resources built up there. They have large walled cities and chariots and weapons. There is a river and mountain ranges to cross to get to the battles, and the Canaanites probably had numbers on their side, since the various cities of Canaan could form alliances with each other. Canaan also had the added bonus of fighting a defensive war. They don't need to kill Israel to win. All they have to do is stay alive. Israel had conquered some territory east of the Jordan, overtaking cities and resources, and so that gave them some strength that they didn't have just a few years ago. But aside from the fact that God is on their side, they are the underdogs in this story. But there is one caveat. Verses 7 and 8 tell us that there is a condition for Joshua if he wants his way to prosper, and if he wants to have success. He must be careful to obey the law of Moses. He must study the law day and night, and he must speak the law, not letting it depart from his mouth. He must study and speak the law so that he will know it such that he will not depart from it to the left or to the right. He must cling close to the law and obey it in everything. And if he will do so, then good. God tells him not to be afraid, not to dismay, but to be courageous. And having received the command from God to take the land, Joshua wasted no time. He sent his officers through the camp to tell the people to prepare themselves. The invasion would begin within 3 days. And as we read in verses 12 through 18, the orders explicitly included the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. And we have talked extensively about them before. You could listen to our message, Tribes East of the Jordan, from June 8, 2019, covering Numbers chapter 32 for the most detail on that. But to give a quick recap, the people of Israel are divided into their 12 ancestral tribes, or 13, depending on how you slice it. Israel is preparing to take the Promised Land, which is west of the Jordan, but leading up to this invasion, They conquered a large swath of the land east of the Jordan, which is where they were for the events recorded in this chapter. Two tribes, the Reubenites and the Gadites, along with the half-tribe of Manasseh, decided that they liked the land in the east and wanted to live there instead of moving on to Canaan. Moses wouldn't allow it, because the fighting force of the two and a half tribes was necessary for the conquest of the land, and he initially viewed their reluctance to cross the Jordan as faithless cowardice. But the two and a half tribes convinced Moses by agreeing that they would be the first to lead the charge into the west, and that they would not return home to the east until the conquest was completed. So here Joshua reminded them of their commitment. Their warriors had to go first, and they had to continue fighting until all the other tribes had a place. And thereafter, they could go back home to their wives and children on the east side of the Jordan. And the people responded with their full support. They not only agreed to obey him in everything as they had done with Moses, but they insisted that anyone who disobeys Joshua, they will put to death. So they're serious about keeping their commitment. In addition to that, they blessed Joshua, saying, "May Jehovah be with you as he was with Moses." So that gets us through the passage. Next, let's consider applications of this passage to our own lives. First, if you keep the word close to you, you will prosper. God made a promise to Joshua that if he would be diligent about continually studying and keeping the law of Moses, then he would have success wherever he would go. Now, I don't want to strain these verses too hard in applying them directly to anyone listening. Joshua was in a special position, and this was a special promise directed at him, not at you or me specifically. However, I do believe that this is a generally true scriptural principle which we can apply to ourselves. And I don't want to belabor the point because we've touched on it many times in other sermons, most notably just a few weeks ago when we studied through Psalm 119. Those messages were published on January 19th through February 1st of 2020. But we can't ignore this principle either. This is yet another of many instances throughout the Bible where the blessings of careful obedience to the law of Moses are extolled. And indeed, as I have said many times, God didn't give the law without any purpose. He gave the law for the benefit of the people who received it. The law fosters goodwill among the populace. It punishes detrimental behavior and rewards beneficial behavior, and it gives good advice on how we can live our healthiest, wealthiest, strongest, and happiest lives. So there is no doubt that if Joshua would follow the law, and if he would lead a people who would follow the law, then their collective obedience would result in the general best interest and strength for their people as a whole. Contrasted to the Canaanites, who will not be living to their optimum, this obedience will naturally tend toward giving the Israelites the upper hand, despite the fact that Canaan has military advantages otherwise. And not only this, but God will recognize Israel for their obedience and will give them his special blessing. Knowing that we have such exhortations throughout the Bible, we can expect such blessings even for ourselves if we do likewise. God hasn't changed and human nature hasn't changed. These are the same rules that they've always been, they're still beneficial for man, and the God who gave them is still pleased with those who live in obedience. So I encourage you to do as Joshua was encouraged to do. Study the law. Meditate on it day and night. Keep it. Don't turn from it. Not a little this way or a little that way. If you and the people around you do this, you will, in a general sense at least, be blessed for having done so. And my second lesson ties in neatly with the first one. We should keep our commitments, even when it is difficult to do so. Keeping the law and keeping your word is not always easy. Sometimes doing so will require us to sacrifice things we love. Sometimes it will require us to do things that we do not want to do. Our sinful desire is to serve ourselves first, and to do that which is in the broader best interest second. And in fact, particularly if we live in a society which is bent away from obedience to the laws of God, we will find that our obedience will cause us to grind against the culture, such that suffering and not blessing will be the result. That is, at least in the short term. Ultimately, God will give blessings to his children for their obedience, even if it comes after death. The two and a half tribes are a good example of a people who devote themselves to the task, even to their own detriment. They had nothing to gain on the other side of the river. Their land was on the east. They were being asked to go and fight on the west. They could have reneged on their commitment. They could have said, Well, we committed to that when Moses was alive, but now Moses is dead, so things have changed. And we don't really need that land. And we don't really want to risk our lives. So best of luck to you guys going over. We hope it goes well for you, but we're staying here in our cities with our defensive walls and our wives and children and fields and livestock. But they didn't do that, did they? They had made a commitment to their brothers in the sight of God, and they made the right decision. They were obedient to God's commands that the land should be taken. They were obedient to God's laws, which say that they must keep their commitments and not vow falsely, taking God's name in vain. They were faithful to love their brothers and to serve their best interests, the best interests of the whole society, above their own personal best interests. And of course, they were probably wise enough to recognize that their own true best interest was not in the short-term gain. Sure, if they abandoned the other tribes, they might get their lands, but how long do you think that they would keep them? If they weren't true to their word, if they thumbed their noses at God, if they ignored right and wrong and the best interest of the whole society. That kind of behavior had left Israel wandering in the wilderness for 40 years in the previous generation, and if this generation had continued down that track, it wouldn't have been long before they succumbed to infighting and attacks from foreigners, to self-inflicted blights, and to divine retributions. This generation was smarter than that, though. They were far-sighted. They were in the long game of setting aside short-term personal interests for the greater long-term good. And indeed, I have said it before, and I say it again now, I think that the book of Joshua portrays to us what is probably the most obedient and God-fearing generation in Israel's history. These were children when they came to belief in God as they watched the miracles of Egypt firsthand. They knew what it was to be slaves, and they knew what it was to be free, and they wanted the freedom that only Jehovah could offer them. They saw the pillar of fire manifesting God's presence as they walked out crossing the sea on dry ground. They ate the blessed manna, the miraculous food of the wilderness, and they saw how their parents had been punished for continual rebellions. They know the power of God, either to do them good or to destroy them, and they don't want the curses that came on their fathers. They want the blessings. So they won't be without mistakes, but on the whole, this is a generation that is ready to take the land in the name of God. And it is my sincere hope and prayer that ours would be a generation of like mind, faithful and true to our commitments and to the Word of God, even when it is seemingly to our detriment. In conclusion, then, we've made it to the book of Joshua. This is the sixth book of the Bible, and it is the first book of Old Testament history. It contains Joshua's account of the conquest of the Promised Land, and in today's introductory chapter, God ordered Joshua to commence the conquest. Joshua was given divine assurance that he would be successful in the conquest, provided that he would be careful to study and obey God's laws. And so Joshua passed word on to the people, "Get ready for the invasion." This included a reminder to the 2.5 tribes of their duty to lead the charge for their brothers. And those tribes reaffirmed that they would honor their previous commitment. In contemplating applications of the passage in our own lives, we considered the importance of knowing and keeping God's laws, and also of staying true to our commitments, even when doing so does not serve our immediate best interests. Next week, Joshua's spies prepare for the invasion in Joshua chapter 2. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.